All right, can you, no, our church doesn't love calling out, but he, let me try this. Can you tell me, I'll put up a sign, and I want you to tell me what it represents. It's not too hard. Yeah, let's see. What's that? Facebook, very cool. What's this one? Bunnings. Oh, okay, I thought if you just had the logo. Yeah, Bunnings. What does Bunnings do? It sells sort of, you know, hardware and now pet stuff. That's really interesting. Hey, what's this one? Target. Yep, very good. Okay, now I want you to tell me what this sign means. Stop. It's not a stop. It's got something to do with a stop sign. Yeah, stop ahead. Very good. And this one, this would be embarrassing if you don't know what that is. Central Valley Church. Look, signs are powerful, aren't they? I mean, they're meant to point to something or inform you as powerful reminders. And it would be naive to think that we don't need them. I mean, imagine if the roads and highways had no signs or street names. Imagine if we didn't have maps or calendars with alerts. Signs are very powerful, and we do need them every day. I'd argue even if you're the most organized person in the world, you will have some sort of organizational system that does what? Reminds you of things. It points you to something. Now, with that in mind, I want you to think about the signs that God gives Israel as they're about to enter into the promised land. As we look at chapters 3 to 5 together, I want you to see what God does for Israel before they enter. Okay, with that in mind, look with me, chapter 3, verses 1. Joshua started early the next morning and left the acacia grove with all the Israelites. They went as far as the Jordan and stayed there before crossing. After 3 days, the officers went through the camp and commanded the people. When you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God carried by the Levitical priests, you are to break camp and follow it. But keep a distance of about 1,000 yards between yourself and the Ark. Don't go near it so that you can see the way to go, for you haven't traveled this way before. Now, quickly, if you don't know what the Ark of the Covenant was, it was a symbol to Israel in both the physical and a spiritual sense of God's presence amongst them. In other words, God was with them. That's what the Ark was meant to represent to them. It would typically be set up in a tent-like structure called a tabernacle, and that setup was all, when they stopped, they'd set up that structure. And pragmatically, it was that because they were traveling around. Think of like a caravan home. Which later, this Ark of the Covenant becomes the temple that the King of Solomon will later build. But what you need to grasp at this moment as they're about to cross the Jordan is what that covenant symbolized. For the people, as they were preparing to cross, for them it was to show them that it is God who goes before them and it is God who is with them. Look, now, it's really interesting. Like, Australia is a big country. And so I don't know how the old explorers and pioneers did it when they came across and they mapped out this land. It's pretty phenomenal. And it's not like Australia is like an easy place to get around. Like, we were talking to a friend of ours the other day. Just like, we've got animals that just kill you. Like, it's not a like, oh, like that's, you know, a really lovely snake. No, that's one of the most venomous snake. Oh, look, a spider that's the size of your hand. Like, we've got a lot of things that can kill you. But one thing I'm struck by is that they went beforehand, mapped out stuff, and obviously people came. I'm eternally grateful for Google Maps and GPS. If I didn't have that, I love my wife, but if we had no maps, we would be perpetually lost. Every time in the car, I'm like, can you direct me somewhere? And she goes, I'm sorry. Are we even in Australia? And so she can, like, she keeps us alive in so many different ways. But if we had no GPS or maps, our family would just get lost and die. But there is something incredibly comforting, isn't there, about knowing where you're heading, especially when you have no idea where you are. It is so comforting when you go somewhere where you don't know what you're doing or where you are, when there is someone who does. Israel didn't have a GPS or Google Maps. They had something better. God was leading the way for them. And notice that in a really powerful way, that it is God communicating to Israel the very steps they're about to take. It is God who not only commands them where to go, appears before them, but is the one who is with them in the midst of it all. But notice another detail about the ark, which is kind of like a box, if you like, a wooden box laid with gold that bearers would carry, priests would carry. It's called the Ark of the Covenant. Now, covenant, for lack of a better word, is the Ark of Promise. Now, you think about that. A covenant was promises made by two parties that there were things that they would do in order to maintain that covenant, that promise. So marriage is a beautiful covenant, for better, for worse, richer, for poorer. Both husband and wife make those promises together. And how powerful is it that what goes before Israel isn't just God's presence, it is his promises. God's promises go before them, reminding them that God is with them and God has promised them something. Now, I wish I had more time to unpack the implications of that, but for a moment, can you consider what it means to have not only God with you, but to have his promises go before you? Like, let me try this. Imagine tomorrow you wake up, it's the first day at a new job or at uni or at school, or maybe it's the first time you're a parent. And just imagine waking up tomorrow in whatever situation you're in, and the first thing you remembered was that God was with you. Not like God, the one who created all of this, the one who sustains creation, holds all of its atoms and subatomic particles together. That God is with you. That you remember that he would never leave you, nor forsake you, nor give up on you. Imagine when you entered that meeting or had that hard conversation that you remembered in the midst of all that and in all your insecurities that that God loved you. And that his love would never fail or be taken away. Imagine if you knew that this God is the God that promised to give you wisdom, the ability to navigate the trickiness and complexity of this world, if he asked. Imagine if you knew, no matter the outcome of your life or what situation you are, that this God is at work in all things for your good. Imagine for a moment that what it would mean to be strong and courageous, not because somehow you've got some sort of amazing strength and courage, but because God is with you. And more than that, God dwells within you. How would that change your day? Should it change your day? Or is that just very nice sentiment that Christians, you know, hopefully give each other? Now, you may be a bit more pragmatic and think, well, theoretically that sounds really nice, but how does that play out practically? Well, read with me as I want you to notice what God says to Joshua. So jump with me, verse 7 of chapter 3. The Lord spoke to Joshua. Today I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, so they will know that I will be with you just as I was with Moses. Command the priest carrying the Ark of the Covenant, when you reach the edge of the water, stand in the Jordan. Then Joshua told the Israelites, come closer and listen to the words of the Lord your God. Now notice what marked Joshua's leadership. And what God wanted Israel to know before he parts the waters of the Jordan, as he did previously with the Red Sea in Egypt. He wants them to know that he is with them and that Joshua's very leadership is grounded on that reality, that it is God who exalts, not Joshua that exalts himself. Joshua hasn't even done anything, really. I get that most of us, when you wake up tomorrow, won't get the parting of the Cunningham Highway. Like, I know you won't get that sign when you're stuck in traffic and you go, God, need you here, and, you know, the cars just split. But there is a lesson there. There is an assurance that God does give us that he loves us, isn't there? That we're a few thousand years ahead of these events, and God has given us the proof of it. But more than that, there is such a compelling sign and wonder and reminder that God gives us that he's so for us. You see, the miracle of parting the Jordan River is all about communicating one thing, that God is with them, and having God with you makes all the difference in the world, all the difference in the universe. It isn't theoretical, it is powerfully practical and life-giving. Because when God says, I am with you, notice what Joshua will do. When God says, I am with Israel, notice what Israel will do. They will move forward, even cross a raging river. You see, what I think most people need more than a miracle is a reminder of who God is and that he is with them. Let me explain. Jump with me to chapter 4. After the entire nation had finished crossing the Jordan, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Joshua. Choose 12 men from the people, one man for each tribe, and command them. Take 12 stones from this place in the middle of the Jordan where the priest is standing, carry them with you, and set them down at the place where you spend the night. So Joshua summoned the 12 men he had selected from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go across to the ark of the Lord your God in the middle of the Jordan. Each of you lift a stone on his shoulder, one for each of the Israelite tribes, so that this will be a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask, what do these stones mean to you? You should tell them, the water of the Jordan was cut off in front of the ark of the Lord's covenant. When it crossed the Jordan's water was cut off. Therefore, these stones will always be a memorial for the Israelites. I think remembering may be a lost art in our instant society, but it never lessens the power of it. I mean, consider Anzac Day. I mean, it was a blessing for us to participate, but hundreds, if not thousands of millions across Australia that day, gathered together to do what? To remember. As a whole, it's something close to a religious and spiritual experience that all centers around this idea of remembering, and in many ways, rightly so. We remember lest we forget. In other words, there is a price to forgetting. We remember what these soldiers did for us. Friends, I get that you'll wake up tomorrow morning and you'll think you're alone. You may think you're alone. You may wake up tomorrow morning thinking no one sees you, no one understands you, no one gets it. But can I reassure you, there is one who is always with you. There is one who always sees you and understands you and gets it. The tension, I think, is that we are so quick to either doubt or forget it. But notice what God gets Israel to do as they cross the Jordan River. 12 people from the 12 tribes of Israel grabbed a stone and placed them as a sign for themselves and for future generations. Why? Listen again to what he says. In the future, when your children ask, what do these stones mean to you? You should tell them, the water of the Jordan was cut off in front of the Ark of the Lord's covenant. When it crossed the Jordan's water was cut off. Therefore, these stones will always be a memorial for the Israelites. God could have just gone, you know what? My miracle is enough. But he tells them, grab these stones. And you think of what stones are. They're foundational, aren't they? They are unshakable. They represent something more solid and firm. And these stones were to tell Israel that God and his promises stop the waters. It is God and his promises that does the impossible. It is God and God alone that saves them. It is God and God alone that will bring them into the land. It is to remind them of what God can and does do. Their nation, their very identity as a people was built on promises. but not made by fickle politicians or rhetorics or, you know, philosophers, but by God himself, the God who can speak realities into existence. And what does God do time and time again to a people that keep forgetting? He backs up everything he says by displaying time and time again that he is mighty enough to do it all. And these stones remind God's people that if it is God alone that rescues and saves you, that it is God alone who keeps his promises, even when you don't, Israel, keep your promises, then understand that God is with you. Remember. Remembering is not a bug but a feature in the Christian faith. We are constantly called to remember. But this discipline and practice of remembering isn't, like, it's not meant to be a killjoy. It's meant to point us to something better. Like, as I said before, imagine traveling somewhere without maps in sight. Actually, I do have to tell this story. Mick the other day picked me up from the station, and we go in his car, and I can't even remember what station we're at, just in the middle of nowhere. And I was like, oh, Mick, do you want me to put my GPS in? He's like, no, mate, got it. It's all in his head. It's like, I was like, whoa, sensei, you know, how do you do this? But he navigated us wherever we were all the way home without any maps. So that was pretty remarkable. But if he got us lost, I'd be like, Mick, you know, pull out my phone. But notice what we would lose if we forgot. And notice what assurances we wouldn't have if we forgot. You know, one of the hardest things I've observed from loved ones who've had people with Alzheimer's is how the nature of forgetting is more than just an intellectual thing. It's the inability to recognize a loved one, the inability to even close yourself or make everyday decisions. It's the inability to reassure and comfort someone or reassure them of who they are, who is with them and what they have. It's more than just memory loss. It impacts everything. We are creatures that were created to remember, create and do all sorts of incredible things, but we are called to remember. We need to remember the Lord because it's more than just forgetting. Remembering him assures us of belonging, of who we are. Let me explain a little bit more. Chapter 5, verse 1. When all the Amorite kings across the Jordan to the west and all the Canaanite kings near the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the water of the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed over, they lost heart and their courage failed because of the Israelites. At that time, the Lord said to Joshua, "Make flint knives and circumcise the Israelite men again." So Joshua made flint knives and circumcised the Israelite men at Gibeath Haraloth. This is the reason Joshua circumcised them. All the people who came out of Egypt who were males, all the men of war, had died in the wilderness along the way after they had come out of Egypt. Though all the people who came out were circumcised, none of the people born in the wilderness along the way were circumcised after they had come out to Egypt. There is so much I can say about that, and I'll get there in a minute. But there are two things that happened before that reading. Firstly, God does exalt Joshua in the sight of all Israel, and they revered him throughout his life. God exalts Joshua. This is more than just a handshake or a passing of the baton, but more a father proudly presenting a child. I never really understood the delights my dad had when I was growing up, when he was proud of me. Like, I mean, it felt good. But until I became a father, I grasped what it was to delight in your son or daughter. It's actually been a delight to see some of the new parents just, I don't know, it's just beautiful when dad just gushes, I don't know if that's the right word, at their child, at their son or daughter. There's something beautiful. There is an exaltation, if you like. In the hit musical Hamilton, which is about the American founding father, Alexander Hamilton, there is a scene when both the main character, Alexander Hamilton, and Aaron Burr sing a song about their child being born. It's called Dear Theodosia. And there is a line in that song that captures something of what I mean. I won't be singing it, but let me read it to you. O Philip, when you smile, I'm undone. My son, look at my son. Pride is not the word I'm looking for. There is something so much more inside me now. O Philip, you outshine the morning sun, my son. When you smile, I fall apart, and I thought I was so smart. Now, God is more than just a gushy father, but make no mistake that he takes great delight in his children. And this is the point I want to make. Joshua was exalted and revered all his life. Why? Because God presented him to his people like a son. I am with him. I am for him. He represents me. Joshua had the responsibility of a son to reflect to his people who God is and who he belonged to. Joshua's identity was that of belonging to the God of all the universe. It was God who gave him his status. It was God that granted him strength. And it was God that enabled him to achieve all that he was about to achieve in his life. The second thing that happens just before we get to the interesting part was what happens is that the stones that they had laid wasn't just a reminder to the community of faith, his people, those who trusted in God, but those stones were meant to be a reminder to those outside. Listen to what verse 24 says. So, about laying the stones. This is so that all the peoples of the earth may know that the Lord's hand is strong, and so that you may always fear the Lord your God. Again, this idea of finding true strength and courage, not from ourselves, but in the Lord, is a defining feature of our belonging to God. Knowing who God is to know that your strength is found in him. Knowing who God is knowing who is worthy to sort of be fearful of. Now, this recently shocked me the other day. Because my kids, I love them. They think I'm the strongest person out. Like, they think I can take everyone. I am a short 5 foot Peruvian. We're not known for like fighting. We'll cook you under the table. But we are not, like, you don't see Mr. Universes. Like, you want us to get tasks done, we'll get the job done. But I do not epitomize strength nor invoke that much fear in people. But for my kids, when they're walking down the street, I didn't know, like, it was so fascinating. We were walking down a street where it was sort of evening and, like, no one was going to harm them. But they came and were like, Dad, we're so glad you're here. No one can stop us. Just like, yeah. I was like, I can't. But for them, I was a reminder of something for them. And for them, they were like, Dad's there, and Dad's a reminder to everyone else, you don't mess with us. We've got this guy. But notice what Israel was meant to grasp. They were meant to understand that belonging to God meant there is no one stronger in all the lands, in all the universe, than our God. If anyone could shut down the street, it was Israel. Because they were holding the very hand of God, if you like. They were to walk down the street and notice what all the nations feel when a nation walks hand in hand with God. When all the Amorite kings across the Jordan to the west and all the Canaanite kings near the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the water of the Jordan before the Israelites until they had crossed over, they lost heart and their courage failed because of the Israelites. I know that there are so many dangers in this world, but remember that a feature of belonging to God is knowing who he is. He is fiercer than a lion, more powerful than the mountains. He is the one that thinks the nations are but a drop in the bucket. When he comes before creation, mountains melt. When he speaks, galaxies come into existence. That isn't theoretical, church. Beloved, you have a father who is with you, who loves you as a son and daughter, and there is no one more mighty than him. Which leads me around to what we read earlier about circumcision. I don't have time to unpack all the intricacies of this practice, but can I quickly note that at its core, circumcision is about belonging. It was a feature that said you were different, you were set apart. But let me quote Tim Keller, who's a lot more smarter than me, and who captures something of the nature of it really well. So this is what he says. Why couldn't God ask for a tattoo? What is this circumcision thing about? It's gross and bloody, and of course, that's the point. Circumcision is gory, it's gross, it's bloody, it's intimate. It's creepy. He says, he finishes off that with a lot more intellectual stuff. But here's his point. There is a cost to being in relationship with God. Belonging to him, what Israel had to grasp is there is something intimate, bloody, to what it meant to be with him. The sign of circumcision captures this reality in very, very vivid ways. You see, the curse of the covenant was to be cut off from God. And this symbol resembled that price, to be cut off, to be set apart. It was meant that they were holy, different, other. And if you think it's messy and gory, like you think about giving birth, it is no less traumatic and messy and gory and intimate. Life comes from cost in this broken world. And though circumcision makes more of a nuanced point about it, what it is meant to emphasize is to belong to God means there is a cost involved. We like to think she'll be right, you know, like belonging to God isn't a big deal. Just relax, God. You know, I'm a good person, I'm fine, I don't need any signs, don't go there. But it was a sign to Israel that God's promises to be with them, to belong to them, comes at a price. But can I assure you that the human practice was only for a time? It was only ever a shadow of something to come. That there is a better, truer circumcision done not by human hands, and one that is done to our heart. And it all revolves around the nature of how we belong to God, how our belonging is dependent upon God's promises and his ability to keep them. So let me close off with these next few verses, as hopefully I tie these ideas together. Chapter 5, verse 9. The Lord then said to Joshua, "Today I have rolled away the disgrace of Egypt from you. Therefore, that place is still called Gilgal today. While the Israelites camped at Gilgal on the plains of Jericho, they observed the Passover on the evening of the 14th day of the month. The day after Passover, they ate unleavened bread and roasted grain, not grain from the produce of the land. And the day after they ate from the produce of the land, the manna ceased. Since there was no more manna for the Israelites, they ate from the crops of the land of Canaan that year." Israel is brought across by mighty acts. Stones are put in place. Joshua is exalted as a son. Those symbols of the stones were to remind Israel not only that they belong to God, not only that God alone saves, but that God is the biggest fish in the pond, if you like. Well, it doesn't do him justice. And circumcision was to remind them that you belong to him, and that came at a cost. And up to this point, they had been wandering the desert for 40 years because of their disobedience to God. They had disgraced themselves. They had failed to be strong and courageous, failed to trust and obey, had failed to go, you know what, we do belong to God. And now as they have crossed, not by their might, but God's, they were to eat and celebrate an important meal, the Passover. A meal that at its heart communicates that God alone saves and that God alone can rid them of their disgrace, remove their sin, forgive them, and reconcile, bring back to peace the relationship they had with each other. And it's this beautiful scene as they finally get to eat the produce of the land, because prior to this, God had provided manna. It's not like, you know, the magic. No, that's not magic. It's manna. It was this food that they found on the ground that God would provide every morning. They finally get to taste the promise fulfilled. They celebrate the Passover that reminds them that a lamb was slain in order that God would pass over them and not bring them judgment. It was a meal that was meant to celebrate a new beginning. So notice what Israel was to remember. Notice what they were meant to grasp at that point as they shared that meal together is the lengths God goes to not just keep a promise for the sake of keeping a promise, but the lengths our God goes to show us who he is and the lengths he goes to have his people as his own. The lengths he goes to make us belong, not just as subjects, but as sons and daughters exalted. The lengths he goes to restore the relationship, to bring forgiveness and restoration. But unlike Israel, we get the full picture. We get the whole story. We know the lengths God goes to be with us. He himself enters the story eventually. And he himself will face the curse of the covenant to be cut off so that we wouldn't. That he would become the willing sacrifice, our Passover lamb, his life for ours, his death our own, knowing full well the type of people he is dealing with. God goes to all the effort for stubborn, ungrateful, complaining, broken and sinful people because he is not like us. And you know what? I get it. I get how easy it is to forget the moment we leave these doors how good God is. If I was an Israelite traveling for 40 years and now about to cross into a seemingly hostile land, I'd be pretty exhausted, pretty skeptical. But what does God constantly do with Israel? He reminds them of his love for them. Remember, remember, remember. I have no idea what tomorrow will bring for you. As you head back to work or study or whatever you're doing, the worries and struggles and efforts that you toil with every day, I have no idea. I can't even promise you that tomorrow, you know what, tomorrow's going to be great. I can't promise you that. But for a moment, can you stop thinking that God's promises don't play and can't play a part in the moment you first wake up? Can you remember the lengths God goes for you? Let me get slightly personal for a second. I can do this because my daughter's not here. This is my little Eden. The other day she came home from school and she goes, "Oh, Dad, you know, I'm really upset." So what's going on? She said, "Someone at school just called me weird," and said a whole bunch of other stuff to her. hurtful things. Now, the wrestle in my heart in that moment was to say something glib like, can you just tell me the child's name and address? I've got a secret, a set of skills. I don't. I just noticed, that was there. Let me be honest. I'm so keen to just, what's that called, child's name again? But I noticed something in that moment. I needed to remind her of something better than my shallow promises of hurting another kid. I needed to remind her that she's a daughter. I need to remind her who she belongs to. I needed to remind her whose words actually matter. You see, all of me wishes I was enough for her. I just won't be. I know there will be a day coming when my words, when I say to her, you are beautiful, will not be enough for her. Where she'll realize, as much as I love her, I am powerless and weak, sinful and broken, unable to keep in the best of my promises. There will be a day that, as much as I want to feel like she belongs, she'll wrestle with it. Yet here is my hope in the midst of it all, that there is someone who doesn't fail in that. There is someone I will never stop reminding her of, and that is my Savior and my King. I will put stones in the middle of the house in order to remind her, if that's what it takes, to remind her that Christ's promises never fail. That for her to find herself in Him is more secure than Mount Everest. Trusting Him is more certain than all the galaxies above and more satisfying than all the foods of the earth. I will remind her, and I will go to every length to remind her what God does for her, who He is, who He sees her as. I have weak promises as a father, and that is so humbling. But there is someone whose promises never fail. I will remind her of the lengths God goes for her. And beloved, as your pastor, I will never stop reminding you of the lengths God goes for you. I get that tomorrow you'll wake up and all the worries will be there. I get it. But don't forget the power of remembering, of taking that moment to taste and see who God is. Now, that's exactly what we're going to do as we close our service together. We're about to remember, just as Israel did when they crossed the Jordan, sharing in the Passover. We are together going to taste and see that our God is good. We are going to remember together what God has done to save us, to bring us into His family. We are going to remember Christ. Remember that He bled for our sins in order to give us a better covenant, a better circumcision, a better belonging. That He was cut off so that we wouldn't be. That He rose so that we would have the assurance and guarantee of life and love, and life in all of its abundance.